Hello and welcome to yet another episode of the Project Scars podcast. Great to have everybody here on this lovely end of summer day. My name is Seth Mears, I'm your host. Joining me today, we've got Mr. Brett Evans. Hello, Brett.
Hey, how's it going?
And Mr. Kyle Hyatt. Kyle, how are you?
Just living the dream, you know? Just good. Really doing it.
Good to hear it. We're a little slow in logging on today, and maybe the bandwidth with which we're broadcasting this is slow on my end because I was trying to get tickets to Jack White in Ann Arbor. He announced a surprise show at a small club called The Blind Pig. I am currently, I don't even know what I am in queue. It's not working anymore, but I'm amongst 3,000 behind the leader in queue for a club that I think is over seats under 1,000. So if I go dark, it's just the hand of God reaching down and trying to give me tickets. But otherwise,
just post up outside with a sixer, you know, just hang out, get the just catch the vibe.
That was basically my methodology for getting into the Geneva Auto Show every year.
And look where that got us all.
Inevitably forgot to register or didn't register on time. So I would just stand there looking awkward until somebody took pity on me and gave me a credential and let me in.
Excellent.
It worked pretty well, as a matter of fact.
It's the Bart Simpson methodology of standing in front of the video game case looking sad so that someone takes pity on you and buys you one.
That's right. There's nothing a little awkward social pressure can't fix, right? Guys, before we get into the heart of the show today, I want to let you know that Project Scars is presented by CarID.com. Fix it, upgrade it, customize it. CarID.com is your car parts destination. And I would be remiss if I didn't remind everybody that we are still in the midst of our ID Days sale. I actually don't have my blurb here, so I'm just going to go extemporaneously. There's a lot of stuff on sale right now. You guys can go to the site, check it out. We've got free shipping on a lot of major items. We've got big discounts on major items from major brands. If you go to the homepage, carid.com, you're going to see discounts and coupon codes right up front. And now is a great time for shop for parts. If you're looking to work on your project, if you're looking to do a repair that you've been putting off for a while, absolutely check it out right now because you could be getting a little bit of a better deal than you normally are getting, right?
I think the big clincher is the wheel and tire packages are all free shipping. So like, not only do you buy the wheels you want, they come mounted on the tires you want and road force balance on the tires you want, and shipping's free. The last time I bought tires alone, it was like $80 in shipping alone.
Yeah.
So that's a solid deal.
Tires and wheels, very heavy.
I like the idea of doing repairs that you've been putting off. That's really germane to the sort of the nature of our show today.
That's right. We're talking about BMW.
That's right.
not to bury the lead. I think we're all super excited. We've talked about various BMWs. Kyle and Brett are both current BMW owners. So we've been talking about the brand a lot. We've got an idea for kind of a recurring show type that I'm really excited about that I think would be fun that we're kicking off with BMW as a brand. Before we dive into it, though, let's talk about our weeks. Kyle, we didn't see you last week. What have you been up to? What's new on in Kyle world?
Well, last week I flew all the way from sunny Southern California to Lexington, Kentucky, which is a place I never thought I'd go for any reason, but I went. And it was to drive the new Genesis G80, which is a lot like the old Genesis G80, but like only marginally better. Which is fine. It's great. It's a good time. Lexington's beautiful. I pet a horse who was very friendly. Yeah, no, she came up to me. It was great. Her name is Barbara's Secret, and we're best friends now. She's pregnant, but I didn't have anything to do with that.
I was about to ask if you're a horse guy, and now I know the answer is.
Now I have big horse energy.
Resounding yes.
Yeah, 4-H, look out. No, it was great. It's a good time. And then I've just been trying to figure out the water ingress issue on my 911, but I think I finally licked the problem.
Way to go.
I finally did it. Yeah. It involved taking apart part of the underside of the dash and poking around with a trombone cleaner that I purchased from Amazon.
Interesting.
But I think we might be there. I got to go take it through a car wash today to find out if I succeeded or if I'm a big idiot.
Trombone cleaner sounds like a euphemism for something that we're not allowed to talk about on this family-friendly podcast, but
that's true. But now if I join a ska band, I'm set. I'm ready to pick it up.
amazing.
So yeah, That's me.
All right. Well, I like a dry 911 for sure, especially on the inside. That's great. And glad to
that also sounds like a euphemism for something we shouldn't talk about. Dry 911. Oh, I don't like a dry 911.
I just like it a little. No, not even going to say it.
Yeah, there we go. Let's just pull the ripcord.
Yeah. Brett, how about you? How has your week been, my friend?
Week was great. Speaking of deferred maintenance and wheel and tire packages, I took a road trip to Mammoth Mountain this weekend, stayed in my buddy's absolutely incredible cabin is an understatement. The entire kitchen, my entire house could fit in the kitchen and living room area, but it was beautiful. It was so fun. Did some hiking, but I drove up in my Z4. They drove up the day of, and they offered to carpool, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to be a little bit irresponsible environmentally and drive my Z4, and it was great. Drove the whole way up with the top down. Once I got into Mammoth, it was like 35 degrees and chilly, which was like, it's like my favorite kind of convertible weather because you just crank the heater and turn on the heated seats, and it's lovely. Great time, except the next day, my power steering went out, and then on the drive home from Mammoth Mountain, one of my tires was losing air, and I pulled over to see that there's a gigantic gash in the sidewall. So that was a really cool thing. But so that's what I get for being a little bit irresponsible and not carpooling with friends. But it was a great time otherwise. Great drive, beautiful drive. Oh my gosh. Like,
hey, you made it home.
It home.
Yeah.
The tire holds air. It just has a little gash in the, like, in one of the plies on the sidewall. So it's clearly not like roadworthy anymore, but I got home. So no big deal.
I think Flex Steel would solve that problem. You just whap right on there, and then you're good to go.
Yeah, well, the other thing is, like, as advertised just mere minutes ago, we have some good friends at a place called CarID.com, so we can probably help solve your tire problem and or have lots of friends in the tire business. So, if anybody out there has some tire recommendations for Brett Z4, put them in the chat. Shoot us an email at tips@CarID.com. We would love to hear about them.
It's on Indy 500s right now, which are probably like my favorite bang for the buck performance tire, Firestone Indy 500s. But I actually kind of want to do like high performance all season on this for some reason. Like, I think it'd be kind of fun to do that Mammoth trip in the dead of winter in my little drop top roadster. So we'll see.
Driving convertibles in the wintertime. It's one of my favorite things to do. I think I've probably shared this story, not on this podcast, but definitely on other podcasts before, that I had an awesome, many, many years ago, I had a, let's see, what would it have been? A 370Z convertible that was, I had close enough to Christmas that I was doing my Christmas shopping in it in Ann Arbor. And it was snowing, like lightly snowing, very cold outside, but with the top down, heat blasting, heated seats on. And I was just getting thumbs up from everybody who saw me, probably because they thought that I was a moron, to be honest. Like, hey, look at that dummy. He doesn't know how to put the top up on his Nissan. But I was just enjoying the hell out of it. Really, really dug it. So
it's truly the best kind of convertible weather, especially like, if you have the right tires, for sure. I remember I drove my mom's Mustang convertible up to Copper Mountain in Colorado one time, and I had my snowboard on the reclined front seat, like wrapped in blankets so it didn't scuff the leather, and had the top down the whole way, and the lifties, or not the lifties, the lot attendants especially, were like losing their fool minds when I pulled in. It was like superhero moment for sure.
I love it. Well, I've had an entertaining week. Last week was great for me. You guys can see I felt moved to throw on my Jim Harbaugh spec Michigan hat that makes my ears look funny, because it feels like it's not quite football season. We have a couple weeks, a couple weekends before college football starts, which I know you guys are absolutely ravenous for. We'll have tons of college football talk on this podcast.
Oh, so much.
No, but moreover, I just live very close to the University of Michigan Central Campus. Students are back. Like, there are lots of parties going on. The energy is up. And at first, as an old guy living here, I'm like, you kids go home. I'm sick of your loud music late at night. But now I've sort of embraced it. It's become fun. It really does feel like you're in a much more lively neighborhood now. So feels like school is back, right? And then beyond that, I was near you, Kyle, at the same time. We discussed this. I was in Knoxville, or flew into Knoxville, and then drove nearby to a close town called Maryville, Tennessee, which is close to where Ford is opening its new Bronco off rodeo experience. So if you are a Ford Bronco sport or Bronco owner, you get to go to this kind of awesome event, school, somewhere between those two things, called the Off Rodeo. There are now, I believe, 5 of them. They've got one in Moab. There's one in Vermont. Vermont or New Hampshire. I'll check that. We have a link to a story that has all of these, so we don't have to rely on my memory. There's one in Texas. And then there's this one in Tennessee now, which is great because it's sort of central, a little bit further north in the country. So Ford's line on the whole thing is that anybody in the, or 80% of their Bronco customers can reach an off-rodeo location within 500 miles, right? So it's like a long drive or an easy flight to get to one of these things. The course isn't ready yet. We drove a really small trail for about 15 minutes, but the reason I was there was the vehicles that's on screen. And this is the 2025 Ford Bronco Sport Badlands with the Sasquatch package. And the Sasquatch package is cool. It's not obviously exactly the same thing, but the big Bronco, the big body on frame Bronco has had a Sasquatch package from, I don't know if it was from the beginning, but for a while now. And it's essentially their hardest core off-road additional like options package. So they're offering that now for Bronco Sport. They're doing it with both the 1.5 liter EcoBoost turbocharged 1.5 liter Outer Banks edition. And they're also doing it with a 2.0T Badlands edition that you can add the Sasquatch to. We drove it very briefly. These were engineering prototypes that were pretty well done, but we drove it for about 20 minutes around a off-road loop and got a sense that the thing is really super capable, especially for something in this segment, right? Ford
there
is
at, go. Look Ford at that.
Is, yeah, that's the demonstration that the one of the instructors did. They've got a little bit of a rock crawling up so you can see the undercarriage of the car, and obviously you can see that it's pretty easy to get a wheel high up in the air. This has got in the back, we've got the Ford's twin power unit, you know, so that you can send power individually to each one of those wheels, and also a locking differential as well, so you can spin them both at the same time. It's riding on 29-inch tires, AT tires that are from Goodyear. I can't remember the exact model, but they seem very capable. And generally,
29-inch Goodyear Territory all-terrain tires?
It could be. Your eyes are better than mine. But so I guess what Ford has done is, you know, bring an already fairly capable SUV in this segment to a new level of capability, right? And I'm really interested to hear you guys have what the take is here, because I put this story on the Ford Bronco subreddit. And got some good engagement. And there was one guy in particular who really took issue with the story, because his point of view, I think in a credible way, right? I think that my line here was that Ford has essentially taken the Bronco Sport, something like the Badlands, which has got a certain level of capability to get you to do off-road stuff, and increased it so that as a consumer, you have more confidence to do more than you could do before, right? His point of view was that the base car is already far more capable than most people realize. And that kind of narrative saying you need to have more to do more is sending the wrong message. It's telling people that they need to spend more money to be able to do something that, in his words, a lot of like front wheel drive crossovers could do to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. So I see his point, absolutely. I think it's a fine line between those two things, between encouraging people to be adventurous with their vehicles, but also to make sure that people understand. I think sometimes they need that push too. They need to be in something that they believe is really over-engineered for the task at hand before they will actually step out of bounds. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I
agree completely.
The Bronco Sport rules. That thing has always been rad. Like, it's way, again, as you said, way more capable than you would think. The new one is even cooler, and with its little itty bitty baby all terrain tires, it looks so cute. It's a little guy with great big shoes. But yeah, I mean, I get what that guy's saying, but also it's called capitalism.
Yeah. Well, there's that.
That's the thing. You don't need to do it. Get this like super aggressive tire package and so forth. But like, people are going to do it because it looks dope. You know,
not even that though. Like, I remember when I was at Truck Trend, we had a long-term Ford F-150, like the first aluminum-bodied F-150, and it tipped the scales at right at like 4,800 pounds and had a towing capacity of like 12,500, something really, really high. And I remember one time we were towing a 10,000-pound car hauler, a 10,000-pound combination, car hauler and car, and it was like that trailer was wagging that truck all over the road. And I know that, like, the idea is like, oh, you're only going to use 10% of your vehicle's capability, blah, 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 blah. But in that instance where you are going to use a lot of it, you want a nice cushion of capability over and above what you're doing. Like in the case of a towing vehicle, that trailer would have felt overweight for anything short of like a gas powered 2500. Or, you know, like maybe we were just loaded it wrong or something like that. But what I'm saying is, like, we didn't have that cushion to feel comfortable. In the case of a Bronco Badlands Sasquatch, like, you could absolutely do that little spot that that car's parked on. You could probably get there in a CRV. But if you tried this in a CRV, you'd end up spinning wheels. You, like, wouldn't have the locking differential you needed to, like, lock up both rear axles and make your way over that obstacle. So, like, if you are in a situation where you feel like you might end up getting stuck in your vehicle, it's just not wise, not prudent. Like, I get where he's coming from. You don't necessarily need all the capability all the time, but if you do occasionally need it, or if you think you are probably going to need it, like, you're in better condition being in something overbuilt than in something you're not going to be able to get through on.
Well, and I think that the driver absolutely matters too. And again, giving this gentleman the benefit of the doubt, who is like, his argument was pretty thoroughly written.
It was. Yeah, it was.
We were going back and forth. Like, I appreciated what he was saying, even though I was coming at it from a different point of view, right? I think that if you are somebody who has a ton of experience going off-road in many different vehicles, you understand the sort of capabilities that you need. You understand strategies that you would employ to get over, around, or through different obstacles. Then you can be really comfortable doing, you know, a lot of stuff and a lot of vehicles. In researching the story, I can't remember how I got there, but I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole and ended up at a short, like a YouTube short or something, that was showing like a Bronco, multiple built Jeeps, and then a Honda Element going through this kind of off camber, super muddy corner where you've got to have the right amount of speed and it's really deep mud. And then basically, if you slide down off the corner, you're in a whole lot of trouble in any of the vehicles. And all of them did it. The way that the Element did it required more finesse than like most race car drivers have, right? But he was still able to do it. But the point is, if you're that guy, if you're Element driver, you're probably very capable of getting anywhere in just about any vehicle. But if you're not, you might not even try if you don't feel like you have an abundance of capability to get yourself out of trouble. Kyle, to your point, I think it's right. You got to spend money to get there, right? And that's why Ford wants to do it. Ford knows that the Subaru Wilderness trims have done super, super well in this space. And so they know, and it does. I think that the truck looks a lot cooler sitting on those big meaty tires. Obviously, they've got the push bar on it, and they've got a lot of optional stuff that you can kit it out with. We showed briefly those flip up tie downs on the fenders, which I think are super, I just think those things are rad. That's a real like functional thing, but it also looks neat. And we don't know what pricing on this is yet, but based on existing Bronco pricing, I think the one that we're looking at right now, this Badlands Sasquatch, is definitely going to be in the 40s, right? Like in the low to mid 40s. And that's a lot of money. That's big Bronco money all day long. So it's all about trade-offs, but you know, Ford won't go broke making this, and that's the point. And that's, you know, we like that because then there are more vehicles that we can drive. So, all right, but enough about Ford and more about going broke, I guess.
That's true. Yeah.
So here's the game we're playing today. I don't know that we actually have a great name for it. I think it's just this is something that we want to do regularly about collecting in different spaces and with different brands, right? A kind of brand focus. And as I said at the top, we wanted to start with BMW. So Kyle, Brett, and myself all went through the exercise with BMWs of picking vehicles in three distinct categories. Right. So we're going to start with vehicles that we think are good for a first car. Now, unlike some of the stuff we've done in the past, we didn't set a price cap for any of these things. So we're all kind of, you know, we're being reasonable here and sort of on the honor system. But the idea is like how much, you know, like a kind of vehicle that you would buy for a new driver, the kind of vehicle you'd buy for somebody who's getting their first car, and those You know, same, there are other requirements that go into too that might be different between the three of us as well. The next tier up in terms of expense certainly is a vintage daily driver. I guess at least it wouldn't have to be, but it could. So what's a car that you would want to drive every day on your normal commute, running your normal errands? That's not a brand new car. And here, what did I even say, you guys? Like something approaching like a price like, new car?
Yeah.
So significant budget, something that you might spend on a daily, but nothing super crazy. And then the third one is no holds barred. Like for BMW, what are the cars that you think are like the ultimate? Like if you could own one car that you would put on Pebble Beach, you know, like when you're able to, when you're both at the correct age and financially able to bring a car to Pebble Beach and show it, or, you know, a slightly different Concours, what's the car that you would want to own to do something like that too? Just really cool. So why don't we do this? We'll go one level at a time. We'll go all the way around and then we'll circle back and start with the next. Sound good?
Sounds great.
I love it. Let's do it.
If at any time any of our viewers have questions, comments, think we're wrong, think they have their own pick, you guys, let us know wherever you're watching this on YouTube, on Facebook, or on Instagram. You can leave us a comment and we'll throw it up on screen and then we'll talk about you. Talk about you talking about us. It'll be very meta. Brett, why don't you start us off, man, with what's your first car pick?
So this was a weird one for me. I don't know. I quite frankly don't know why I picked it because I don't actually like this car that much myself, but I do think it's a properly pretty good car. This was my pick. This is the F30 generation BMW 320i. This was the base model. This had like a 180 horsepower version of their 2-liter turbo 4. And the reason I picked it is, quite frankly, because I kind of think it's just like a nice modern distillation of like BMW's core values. It's not extremely well equipped. I think this is probably a Sensatech interior. It's not super fancy, not like fancy leather. This one's an automatic, but you can get it with a 6-speed manual. And it kind of just feels, you know, like a relatively like low powered 4-cylinder engine, 6-speed manual transmission, rear wheel drive. It kind of just feels like a very good basic like BMW formula. So this was my pick. They're about, they start, you know, right at around, you know, $8,000 to $10,000 with, you know, about 100,000 miles. But you can get them up to, you know, $20,000 with very low miles and very nice options. And I kind of just think it'd be a good introduction to BMW ownership. This engine is relatively reliable, especially the 180 horse version is so understressed. Like there's just no, very little boost going into that engine. So I think it'd be a good, reliable option for someone who wanted something kind of cool as their first car or their first BMW, but maybe wasn't ready to jump in with, you know, needing new rod bearings every 50,000 miles and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I remember when this car came out, I was working at BMW at the time. And I think like the big thing going around the internet was that you could get the joke was at the time, the quote unquote Jalopnik spec, because you could get it with a 6-speed manual, rear wheel drive and like a sport suspension package. And it was like under $40,000. And like, that was like the big thing. Nobody bought that, of course, because that's not a real thing, but like, you know, you could, and like, I mean, God, that ship has clearly sailed now. I can't imagine getting a 3 Series for under almost 50. Yeah, these things are rad. I always like the way they look. They're really understated, but nice.
Yeah. It's, in the world of 3 Series, which gets sort of, you know, like, especially this one, not really gaudy, but like it gets scoopier and slashier and a lot more going on, like bigger wheels, obviously. The 320i, which I think I had all of maybe one night in one time when this car was new. It was, I would be happy to drive it as a daily driver with a 6-speed manual for sure. I think that would be a lovely car. I think this car in any version would be awesome for a young driver because it's going to be pretty safe. It's going to be fun. It's going to be sort of cool. But also they're not going to get themselves into a ton of trouble either. So, and the price is, I mean, God, it blows my mind. This is just a factor of how old I am. And I realize that this car is now almost 10 years old, but that car that we're looking at right now being advertised for just under $11,000 seems wild to me.
Yeah. And I also really appreciate, I lost my train of thought, so I don't know what I really appreciate. I really appreciate that, you know, this era of BMW Turbo 4 was so incredibly efficient. I remember when the F30 came out, I was in a E34 at the time, and my E34 got 15 or 20 miles per gallon all day long with 220 horsepower. And then this car comes along with a little bit less power, but it was getting 35 or 36 miles per gallon. Like this is Hyundai Elantra territory in terms of fuel economy. And you're getting a pretty nice driving experience and a pretty cool, interesting car as well.
Dig it. I think it's a great pick. Very sensible. Well done, Brett.
Excellent choice.
Thank you.
All right, Kyle, what do you got for us?
Well, unsurprisingly, let me see here. Hold on. Wait a minute. Let me make this work. I don't know how to live.
It's very difficult. We are in desperate need of a podcast producer. So if you're out there and you work for extremely cheap,
that would be the greatest.
That would be great to know.
Yeah, I don't. Wait, it's not letting me. There's no option to screen share.
Oh, I'll get it, Kyle. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. Right. Anyway, but unsurprisingly, my pick is the E53 X5 because I have one. Yeah,
and still, it can be yours today.
With a few caveats. So, the thing that makes the E53 great is that it's super cheap, right? It's crazy cheap. I will say that the V8 ones are really, really cheap, and like they're super enticing because cool, big 4.4 liter V8 or whatever. But they are pure, unadulterated trash. They are so bad and so unreliable. That even I won't touch them. And that's saying something. But the six-cylinder cars, interestingly, have slightly higher resale prices because they are fairly reliable. They've got the M54 B30 engine, which is what's in mine. Most of them are automatics, which is like the 5-speed Steptronic, which is a great, perfectly serviceable transmission. You get okay gas mileage. That's never really a strong suit with the M54, but it's like one of the best engines BMW ever made in terms of like reliability, serviceability, all that good stuff. And these things are like, they're old enough now that all of the stuff that goes wrong with them regularly, or like, you know, all the big issues have been identified, and like people in the community have like come up with fixes for them, or like workarounds for difficult repairs or whatever. And this era of BMW in general is pretty easy to work on. Like the whole like German car, like you need a bunch of computers and blah, 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 is mostly not true. Like you probably need an OBD2 scanner, but you're not going crazy, right? Again, I paid like $2,000 for mine, which is obscenely cheap because this is a manual transmission one. They are available, but they're considerably more expensive because they're rare.
What are you in on it so far?
Don't ask me that question. How dare you?
That's just rude.
Yeah, no, I think I probably like $5,500, $6,000.
So when you reacted like that, I was expecting the answer to be in the five digits, but $6,000 for like a decent BMW SUV with some kind of sporting potential, like that's not bad.
No. And I mean, granted, I haven't done all that work yet. I just bought all the parts, but still, it's going to be a fair amount of work. But yeah, it's great. It's like they're all-wheel drive. Full-time all-wheel drive, so you don't really need, like, worry about, you know, dealing with like 2-speed transfer cases and stuff. They're not particularly amazing off-road, but in terms of like just a car to live with, they drive really well. Like they're so much fun compared to like the other SUVs that were available at the time, I think, for the most part. Interiors hold up really well. Like BMW leather from that era is, I don't know what it's made out of, some kind of secret like space toxic waste or something, but it just toughs it out forever and ever.
My nephew had this same era of BMW. He had a 3 series, and he lived in Telluride at the time, and so it was just like kind of hell on wheels. Like he had a really hard time with it a lot of the time, and I kind of wanted him to get one of these for like all the reasons that you just described. Like it's just like kind of a cool offbeat choice. He really liked having a BMW. Like doesn't care that much about cars or like image or anything like that, but he just kind of like enjoyed the appeal of a BMW and the build quality and stuff like that. And I think this would have been a great pick for him overall.
Yeah. So again, it's a affordable, relatively sturdy, you know, still cool, first car pick. Like, and again, like with 220 horsepower and 4,500 pounds of SUV, you're not getting into a lot of trouble. Let's be honest with each other. Like this is, you know, you'd really have to be trying to be, in speeding ticket territory, I think. So yeah, there we go.
I love it. Yeah,
I think a biased choice, but a choice nevertheless.
No, I think this is a great one. I think this is something that you would put a kid in today without feeling that bad about it, because it's going to be reasonably safe. It's inexpensive. You sort of pass the part of the awful stuff, hopefully, in terms of maintenance, and then maybe they can even do something themselves. Who knows?
Yeah, it's got like traction control and airbags and crumple zones and all that good stuff. I mean, hell, my 911 doesn't have traction control, so. You know,
and if you got one, especially one of the automatics for, you know, 4 or 5 in decent condition, you wouldn't feel too bad inevitably when your teen driver put it into a parking berm or something like that.
Yeah, for sure. Like, and they're so plentiful in junkyards and stuff. Like, again, if you want, I wouldn't recommend this for somebody that doesn't work on their own car. Mm-hmm. Just because ultimately you're going to be paying shop rates to fix a car that costs $3,000 to buy. But if you do work on your own car, if you do want to learn, it's a great option. Like, they're super, super easy, super easy.
Nice. Yeah. And I think being completely fair, like, we not only love BMW, like, we've all at some point put our money where our mouth is there too. It's not necessarily a brand that you buy if you don't want to do anything yourself, right? Like, so a lot of people,
especially not this age of car,
would shy away from a first car, a first car as a BMW or a BMW as a first car, because they don't do the work, and they would have to pay not only labor rates but usually pretty expensive labor rates. Although my guy Larry down the way would
shout out Larry,
would do it for no problem.
I mean, honestly, if you're going to take a BMW to like non-specialist mechanic, an M54 BMW is a way to go. Like, they're just robust iron block pigs. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't need super fine, like, ridiculous care, you know?
No. And like, the biggest issues are all like oil leaks. And like, occasionally you'll get like a Vanos rattle or a DESA valve, but that stuff's all super easy and external. And like, you can replace a Vanos unit. It's $400 to buy a rebuilt one, and you can have it swapped out in less than an hour with like basic hand tools. Like, it's that kind of car, which is great.
It's awesome. Good pick.
Yeah. So love it.
My pick is not that. My pick is, some of the things that we've talked about, but many, very different in many ways. And that is not necessarily this one right here on the screen. For those of you that are listening and not watching, we've got a 2015 BMW i3 Rex with the range extender. These are the primary reasoning for this as a good first car is that it's cheap, right? It's cheap and it's newer. So newer in my mind, sort of the same as Brett's 3 Series pick equates to. I'm putting my kid in it. Like, it's got a lot more safety engineering in it than even, you know, a slightly older X3 with a little bit more mass. So I also think that it's kind of would be a cool, fun car. I can see myself being 16, 17, 18 years old and wanting to get a car and having this and being really into it. It's kind of unique, even though they're not uncommon where I live. I'm sure there are more of them in California even than I see around here. And I see a fair number of them. I've always thought that it was a neat looking car. And I think, like, as a kid, I could really get into it. I like the base battery. Now, for still reasonable money. Like I said, they're asking $9,000 or $10,000 or something for this car. This one's $9,700. I saw them at this age for as low as like $7,500 or something like that. You can spend a little bit more money and get one of the bigger battery cars. And that's probably a better way to go if we are talking about a kid or a car for a kid and not for a slightly, you know, older person driving their first car. But for a kid, having a car that has there are two things. Like, the maximum range of this, even with the range extender, is maybe 140 miles or something like that. Like, out of the box, this battery got you 80, I think under 90 miles of EV range. And then if memory serves, the gas tank is just like a 1.1 liter little peanut gas tank. So you get, you know, another maybe like 40 miles of range, gas powered range out of that too. It's not that I don't want the kids to be able to drive it anywhere, but you're definitely, you know, like, limiting the operating envelope of a vehicle for a younger person who doesn't necessarily need to be able to drive hundreds of miles away without more planning. And then I think the other part of it is actually kind of interesting too. Like, one thing that I'm seeing is my kids who are still very young are getting older, is that, like, teaching them how to plan, teaching them how to kind of organize their thoughts a little bit is something that you really work on a lot. And I do think that having an EV that has limited range requires, it's, you know, it's like another chore. You've got to remember to plug it in. You've got to remember, do I have gas in that small gas tank if I'm going a little bit further? So it's causing them to interact with the vehicle in a way that's more active and not just passively get into a car and take off and drive it like it's an appliance. And I think that's something that Nets gains in terms of creating like responsible drivers down the road. So now, a lot of other stuff that we've talked about, like the, especially the cost to repair it if things go wrong, I imagine it's going to be crazy, right? I don't imagine this is a car that's going to be super easy to work on myself should I have one in the garage tomorrow, right?
I mean, I kind of wonder, because the range extender is it a two-cylinder or a three-cylinder from a motorcycle, isn't it?
I think it's a two-cylinder.
But it's like a tiny little thimble of an engine. Like, I kind of suspect it might make a good vehicle to kind of like learn to tinker on as well. Like, the battery and electrical stuff you probably don't want to touch in your garage. But like, if you just need to do an oil change every once in a while, I think this would be kind of be a fun car for a teenager or a new driver to learn how to do that on.
Yeah, certainly they would. It would be a fun science project, right? To try and figure out some of that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, these things are rad. I love the i3.
I do too.
This has like the most normal looking interior of any i3 I think I've ever seen. But they're great. They're so like weird, and I love the like carbon fiber safety cell chassis, and like it's BMW being as weird as it can, like from a period where it had more money than anybody.
You can kind of see it a little bit in this car. The like forward portion of the dashboard kind of has that like. Mm-hmm. But I think it's like forged carbon or pressed carbon or something like that. Like,
I think it's like that. You can see it like in the yeah, like right in the door sill or whatever area. Yeah. And yeah. Mm-hmm. But no, these things are great, and they're slow and they're narrow and they're tiny and easy to park. Like, they're awesome. It's a perfect city car especially for a kid.
If these had windows that rolled down in the back, it would be like genuinely like fairly high on my list of like my own personal commuter car, you know, like just having something that got decent fuel economy and was just kind of fun and easy to drive around. And I love that if you completely deactivate the traction control, the rear tires are something like 175 millimeters wide. And so like with 170 horsepower from the electric motor, like you can just rip some ridiculous donuts in this thing.
It's so funny. It's such a strange like wheel tire package on this car to get like all the efficiency that they wanted out of it. Have such a narrow tire on such a tall wheel. And they do look a little, I think that they look awesome. I've definitely talked to a lot of people who think that they look super dorky because of that stance, especially when you look at it from behind. But overall, let's put it this way. As coming from a guy whose first car was the Toyota Space Egg minivan, like, I don't think that this is a car that you would forget as your first car, right? It's not a sort of anonymous one. So for that alone, it might be worthwhile. Let's hope it lasts longer than the 11 months that my Toyota minivan lasted me.
Good pick.
All right, Kyle, we're back to you, and we are moving up in the category. So now we are talking about vintage daily drivers with a robust budget, pretty much of your choosing, but we're talking, you know, cheap new car territory here. So where are you taking us?
I'm once again taking us back to the golden age of BMWs, the early 2000s. So to preface my pick, BMW did this thing. If you're not old and weird like we are, BMW did this thing at the time called BMWfilms.com. So this is like early internet web 1.0 stuff, but they posted these like incredible high budget films made by like real directors. This one is by Guy Ritchie. And if you could watch this and not want an E39 M5 after, I don't know that you're entirely human. Because it's the coolest thing. Like, it's got Blur in the soundtrack. This is Clive Owen before the Transporter. I think like this is what probably got him the Transporter film series. Yeah. Madonna, who was at the time married to Guy Ritchie. But yeah, my pick is the E39 M5. It is
that one shot right there is the hero shot of that car.
Oh, like, it is one of the greatest cars ever. Full stop, I think. Definitely one of the best BMWs. The E39 still looks modern. It's still super attractive. This one has a 400 horsepower naturally aspirated V8 and a 6-speed manual as the only transmission. It rips. It's rear wheel drive. It's so good. It's just the best. It's the best. And it was a really nice one is probably into the, like, the mid to high 20s, low 30s now. But I mean, again, like, it's four doors. It's comfortable. You know, you got all the modern conveniences for the most part. And again, like, if you need something with better infotainment, like, you can upgrade that with this. But yeah, like, this thing is just him, like, ripping around Los Angeles, just hanging the tail out everywhere.
We need to do a dedicated podcast episode where we just do a group watch and live react to, like, two or three of the best BMW films.
Yeah, it's, again, it was like a genius, like, marketing exercise that somebody probably lost their job over, because I think it's like,
well,
you know, but so, God, this thing is so cool.
No, this is the ultimate pick. We decided early on that we weren't going to, like, overlap with our picks. And when Kyle put this one in, I kind of, like, had a little kind of moment, because this would absolutely be mine too.
Well, that's why I got in early, got in first.
Yeah.
Because I wanted, there was no other option. I don't even mind the goofy two-tone interiors, which most of them had. Like,
well, so I actually properly, like, I love the red and the blue ones for, like, ironic reasons. Like, they're very silly, but I properly love the gray and the black that he has in this one. This is my perfect spec. I'd maybe do a different exterior color, but, like, the interior with the gray and the black and then the aluminum trim is just like, oh, it's so good.
Yeah, this one is, like, you know, the peak German rainbow experience. It's got, like, I owned an E39 wagon with just a six cylinder, like, super pedestrian, but every time I got into it, I was thinking about this and just being like, that's so cool. Like, yeah, they're great cars. And like a non-M, even like a 540i M Sport with a six speed is pretty close to this experience without most of the cost. And those are like under 10 grand, I think.
Yeah,
so
easy.
And it's just, yeah, it's so good. Like, this sure is it. This is BMW to me, full stop.
I'm going to stop sharing before we get to the twist.
I've had maybe there was an M5, the second to last M5 launch was in Portugal, I believe. And they brought out a bunch of cars from the Heritage Collection, including all, like, I think they had every generation of M5. So we had a chance to do, like, kind of road loops in all of them. I wasn't able to do all of them because of the other sort of programming around the event, but I did drive that car very briefly. It's the only time I've had it, and it was really beautiful, but it was, you know, on tight, like, village streets in a Portuguese village. So it wasn't like I was winding it out. What I remember, and I'm happy to recommend, if I can find the link, I will share it. I don't think that they're doing it anymore, but friend Eddie Alterman, who was still works at Hearst, was the editor-in-chief of Car and Driver for many years, did a great podcast a few years back called The Car Show with Eddie Alterman. And he did, it was essentially, he was kind of talking about one great model or one great topic per podcast. He did an episode on M5, specifically on the E39. He had Malcolm Gladwell with a guest. And I can't remember as a guest. I can't remember whether or not the E39 was Gladwell's or not, but they were essentially doing back-to-back drives in an E39 and the then current M5 to talk about the sort of, you know, push and pull of what was great about BMW then and what's kind of amazing about the cars now. And it was just like, I remember listening to it on like a Saturday, walking around the house doing chores and just being enthralled because I love the car. It's such a, like, perfect example of what most of us love about BMW as a brand. And yeah, I agree. I think it's like an ideal pick for a daily driver. Good one.
A friend of mine's dad had one growing up, and yeah, I would just, that car ruined me. Like I would have, if I hadn't seen that film or my friend's dad's car, I would have so much more money now. I'd be a functional adult with, like, dignity and self-respect and, like, a very positive bank balance, you know, like, but instead I'm a broken man with broken German cars.
That's such a rich and varied life experience.
It's true.
Well worth it. Well worth
That's
it.
True. Regrettably, yeah, I cannot pay my rent in fun.
All right, Brett, bring us back from the mountaintop. What are you picking for your daily driver classic?
So I mentioned it a little bit before we started. I'm cheating a tiny little bit on this one. This is a little bit out of my price range in terms of, like, you know, a lowish priced new car, $37,000. But this is a BMW E3 sedan. It was sold in America as the 2800 and then later as the Bavaria. This particular one is a 3.0 SI, which is, like, my favorite. Fuel injected M40 or M30 inline six engine. This one is like my perfect spec with the blue and the Campagnolo wheels, and it's got a blue velour interior just straight out of the 1970s.
Yeah.
But this car, I don't know what it is about the Bavaria, and it's kind of underappreciated, or maybe not. Like, it's one of those cars that it's not a 2002. It's never going to be a like super highly desirable vintage BMW experience, but I still just love them so much, and I want one so, so bad.
Yeah, but it's got that shark nose front end too that really speaks to what became. For a while there, it seemed as though the BMW performance thing was going to be this sort of forward canted nose, right? We went from this to like 6 years to M6, and all of those had a similar profile, and then they kind of backed away from it. I think this car is absolutely beautiful. There's so much about, like, even if you take away like most of the bodywork, if you look at this car from the belt line up with the glass house and the sort of shape DLO and all that stuff, is just really amazing, like beautiful, classic, looks light, and it looks really special too. So
that's my favorite part about cars of this era, especially BMWs, is the pillars are so thin. The greenhouse is so vast. I had an E30 for a little while, like a very undesirable pre-update 318i. And the thing that I love the most about it, and the thing that like my non-car friends commented about it, was like, wow, there's a lot of light in here. Like the glass is really nice. And I feel like I've been chasing that high ever since, and I'm not finding it in modern cars. So I need to find one. I need to go find a 70s BMW and enjoy it again.
For sure. These things are rad. I agree with like that sort of the greenhouse thing. You got the pronounced Hofmeister kink.
Yeah.
That nose is iconic. It's good. Sam Smith had a Bavaria that he ran for a long time as a daily. Hmm. And I think his was, as is sort of Sam's habit, a kind of a rust bucket turd of a car. But he I remember talking to him about it once and just loved it. Absolutely loved it. And the mechanicals of this thing are great too. Like the M30, they use that. My E28 535S has an M30 B35 in it. Like it's a tractor engine, but it's like makes a ton of torque. It's like, you know, super stout. Yeah, these things.
My 535, my E34 had the same engine as well, a M30 B35, and it was a great, like such a great cruising engine too. Like it just was such a smooth, lovely vehicle to drive. And I kind of think that these like very early American era BMWs are like just kind of that nice balance of like you get a vintage driving experience, but it'll still do 75 on the highway, still get out of its own way, still has air conditioning. Like, you know, it's maybe not quite like safe in terms of modern car. Like, you know, I don't know that I'd be feel super comfortable like packing my, you know, in 20 years, packing my family of four up and going on a long trip in one of these. But I love the way they look. I've always loved the Bavaria, and it's on my list. If you insist that I have a more reasonably priced example, I did find one that is not quite as like aesthetic, but you know, again, a little bit more reasonably priced. And that's this one right here. This one swapped with that engine, Kyle. And it's also got a 5-speed, so it's even going to be more reliable and more like easy to use. But, doesn't quite scratch the aesthetic itch for me. It's a little more, a little bit too modern. But ooh, 20
seats, grand. Though. Those seats. The wheels can go, but the seats are just right.
I guess the other thing that we haven't talked about here, but like, you know, because it doesn't really matter with the first car idea, but when we get into a daily classic, like there is an element of collecting, right? Like, and are you buying a car that might not lose all of the money that you've put into it when you're ready to sell it? And I think certainly more than my pick, I would guess. Maybe M5 is a little, I think, I haven't looked, but my intuition is maybe those prices have stabilized a bit on the E39s.
They have, yeah.
That feels like because they didn't make very many of them, or they certainly didn't make and sell very many of them in the US. I think that if you spend a little bit more money to get a nicer example and look after it, it's a car that could appreciate or at least not lose a lot of value as you own it and drive it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Those seats are those are really incredible. Pretty fantastic. Again, for those of you who are listening, I can't really describe them, but you should come back and watch the show. About 49 minutes in, just to take a look at the Bavaria seats. They're lovely.
Deeply bucketed and so blue.
Beautiful.
So I never owned like a Bavaria or any E3, but I own sort of the contemporary Mercedes of the era.
Yeah.
And I've driven an E3. And man, like I really like get a sense of, I don't think ever in their history was sort of like the gulf between Mercedes and BMW with their like their thinking, their design and engineering ethos like bigger. Because the Bavaria is like kind of sporty, like it's for what it was. It was like, I think it's relatively quick. Like they were focused on making it nice to drive, like, you know, and engaging. It was sort of a very modern looking interior and stuff. But like the W108 and W109 Mercedes, which that's what I had, like I had, it was a 2.8 liter mechanically fuel injected inline six. And I swear to God, I'd have to book an appointment if I wanted to get on the freeway. Like it was so slow. It's like a giant bus size steering wheel. It's very Baroque kind of, you know, like it's just so completely different. And I guess it's, again, it speaks to kind of like why we love BMW from, you know, all eras, I guess, but this sort of commitment to making something that should be enjoyable to drive regardless of what it is.
Sure. And that era, you know, famously with the 2002 is that coming to the US are the cars that made people realize it was that aha moment for this market for enthusiasts. Not making deep inroads. I would say probably the E33 series is the one that started to make really deep inroads into yuppie culture and 80s culture and things like that. But the reputation that carried the E30 to that success, I think, was based on lightweight, great handling, great powertrains, you know, like really enthusiastic behavior across the board. And certainly Bavaria speaks to all of that. So good stuff. Great pick. I would love to daily one of those too. I'm not in a position, a family position to do it, but I think, you know, a couple years down the road, I can see myself for sure.
I get tempted every time they come up on, you know, Bring a Trailer, Cars and Bits, Hemmings. I get tempted to sell my Z4 and do one of those. I love a convertible. It's kind of the only thing that like keeps me, you know, engaged in the Z4 life. But oh my gosh, the moment I have extra money for a second needless daily driver, I'm going to get a Bavaria.
Well, I'm on yet again. I'm on, I don't know, quite the opposite end of the spectrum. This is still a strong enthusiast pick, I would say. But my pick for my classic daily driver is certainly much newer. I'm talking about an E90 M3. So the one that I've got pulled up here that Brett just grabbed. Oh no, this one did sell. Is a 2008. This is the M3 of the 4 liter V8, super high revving, 400 plus horsepower, not quite 300 pound feet of torque, really, really amazing 6-speed manual. And it's a car. The funny thing is, looking at this as a classic daily driver, I've always made the argument that this is a truly spectacularly driving M3. And I will go to my grave believing that. The counterpoint was always, but it's not always the best daily driver, because to get all the power out of it, you really do have to wring its neck, right? You need to be higher in the rev range to make it do what it's got to do. I guess the you know, if I was actually forced to live with it, I think that would be okay, because the reality is I don't need to go 9/10 most of the time. I don't need to have that super visceral experience. And it's not like the car is bad to drive when you're just taking it easy in it either. It's still really comfortable. Again, we're talking a lot about like modern conveniences. Obviously now we're up to 2008. It's got everything that I could possibly need. In fact, my almost pick here was just the generation prior, was an E46, because that's my favorite body style of M3 of all time. I really, really love that. I think it looks cool, especially E46 was the first M3 I ever drove. So I have a special personal connection to it. But it was only a coupe, right? So for a daily driver, for me, I really need to have rear doors right now. I need to have back seats. I don't need to have a huge back seat, but I think that the smallish back seat of the E90 would do just fine. And even though this one, I was a little bit surprised when I was looking through a couple of listings. This one has got some paint damage. It claims to be completely unmodified, and it went for almost $35,000. You don't have to spend $35,000 to get one of these. Like, you can get them in the $25,000 range or below all day long. So I'm not sure. I didn't do the research exactly to know what was very special about this, but I do think that they're, you know, like Kyle, like you were talking about with the E39. Like, you can get this for, you know, it's not super cheap, but it's pretty reasonable money for something that you're really going to enjoy. Mm-hmm. I will demur to you guys with the question of like reliability and maintenance issues on this car, because I actually don't know on this engine. Like, I'm sure that there are a lot of nightmare scenarios. I'm just unaware of what they are.
Rod bearings are most of them.
Rod bearings. Yep.
Yeah.
So rod bearings every like 90,000 miles. And then some of the higher mileage cars have been having like catastrophic non-rod bearing related engine failure, which is like new. Yeah. Like I know in like the last year that some of the owners of these are realizing that there's like a relatively unsolvable, unpreventable engine failure at like 200,000 miles. But, you know, two sets of rod bearings and then... Yeah, exactly. Yeah, make sure to have your fun and get it unloaded at 180,000 miles and let the next guy deal with it.
For sure. These things are so good. They're so
good. I love these.
That engine is unbelievable. And like, I think, you know, people put such a high premium on the six-speed manual for these. But unlike so many other like dual clutch transmissions from this era, this one actually worked really well. So yeah. Like, honestly, for a daily, I'd probably get the DCT. Like, it works as an automatic. It works in, like, you know, if you want to like shift it yourself and you're saving a little bit of money. But yeah, man, what a pick. And I've only driven the coupe. But everybody, I remember like contemporary reviews always said that the sedan drove a little bit sweeter. Mm-hmm. I believe. I wonder if it's like a wheelbase thing or I don't know, but
I'm not sure. I mean, I never really had any issues with any of them other than the convertible definitely felt heavier. The convertible felt a little unwieldy. I would still love it. Like I still had.
Yeah. That engine note would make any performance sacrifice worth it, frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, the sedans were always, sort of on rails, any of the many times that I've been behind the wheel of one of these guys. And it's a good call on the DCT too. I don't think about it. My natural inclination is to click on the listing that says six-speed manual. Right. But I think that you're exactly right. I think that was, a really good implementation of the DCT. And I don't remember ever walking away thinking like, that's a bad transmission. I wouldn't want to own a car with that in it. So, which is rare.
The thing that I love about this pick, and this is like peak BMW nerdery, is that this is the only model year that the M3 sedan got the pre-facelift taillights, but the coupe headlights, which I love. Like, I love this era of BMW. The E90, like, I've talked about it before. My boyfriend has a facelifted E90. I love the era of cars so much, but I love especially that, like, this one has kind of these weird, like, you know, full oval taillights, whereas the facelift got kind of a little bit more angular look. And I just like, I love 2008 M3 sedans for that reason. So nerdy, so cool. Great pick.
Mm-hmm. Nice. One thing that's rad is there's companies now, I think it's like Evan Churi or something like that. They make a fully carbon air plenum, like airbox and plenum. Uh-huh. And it's like the carbon is thin enough that it just makes the intake noise. It like starts to cause the reverberations with the carbon, and it makes the intake noise just unreal. Yeah. Like it's like a $5,000 intake, but I don't know that I would even care because like the sound that it makes is so good. Awesome. And you know, I think, you know, they say intake noise is for you, exhaust noise is for everybody else. You know?
Yeah.
All right, let's keep going. I'm having fun with this. We've got one last round, the most glorious round, the concourse round. And I believe, Kyle, we are back to you to lead us off with the big boys.
All right. I mean, this is the same era as Brett's Bavaria, but this is it. Like, this is like the BMW for a lot of people. It's the E9 coupe. It's the 3.0 CSL. It's called nicknamed the Batmobile. This one I drove 2 years ago in Monterey. I was on their press program, and it's the thing is, so like the Batmobile part of it, this is hard to, you know, you can't really tell what this one is. There's all this crazy aero that German law prevented them from selling installed on the car. So BMW just put it in the trunk and like left it to the owners to buy. But I mean, this thing, it's again, like, it's just that greenhouse is, there's so much glass. Like, it just feels so open. And the dash feels far away from you when you're sitting in those like Scheel race buckets. And it's got, you know, like a long throw transmission, and you're just revving the crap out of that 3-liter straight six. It's just, it's like, it feels like a big German muscle car. And that's, I mean, that's basically what it is. And you know, very famously, BMW raced these things like crazy. And even, you know, a few times, once they put a turbo engine in it, they've, you know, never got to production, but they ended up giving Porsche a run for its money. And that's a big deal in the 70s, because that was like, you know, kind of that era of motorsport was dominated by Porsche. But yeah, this thing was so good. Like it feels old, you know, in the right way, but it also was fast enough, and like that you know I was just like ripping through these canyon roads around Carmel and just like having the best time, you know. Yeah, I think about this car all the time, and they cost so much money now, like it just staggering amounts of money, because they've got aluminum bodywork, and you know, it's all very special. There's the Batmobile version.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at listings right now, and I'm actually sort of, maybe my scale has been thrown off because of the cars that I've been looking at, but I'm seeing, and again, like not accounting for provenance and actual condition of the car, you're six figures all day long, but I guess I was a little bit surprised that you're, you know, I'm seeing one for 115,000. Here's one that went for 98.5, right? So
yeah,
it is bananas money, but like, it's not quite as crazy as I expected it to be.
Right, it's not quite like M1 money, but like, It's a lot of cashish for what is effectively like just an old BMW, you know, like it. But yeah, like everything about it, with the big balloon tires, and you know, it's just,
yeah,
it just screams 1970s. You know, I love it. It's so rad getting to drive that thing around. Definitely a career highlight for me so far. Like really, really cool.
Without the Batmobile stuff, the Batmobile stuff is great. Like that's a cool looking car all day long. But even without the Batmobile stuff, I think the 3.0 CS, I think the E9 Coupe is like top three best looking BMWs of all time. Like this beautiful little roundel in the C pillar that BMWs tried a couple times to much less success. I think it looks so good on this car. This is just such a phenomenal, phenomenal machine.
Yeah, just a staggeringly pretty car. And every time I see one, which is even around LA, not that common, I just get so excited. Like they're so cool.
Super rad. For those of you watching, I found another one that didn't have the wing and the aero bits on it that was sold recently. And the profile is just incredible on it. Again, just a classic coupe. Unbeatable. Good one.
Very, very attractive machine. Solid work.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Brett, you're up. What's going on your Concours lawn?
This one is one of their newer offerings, but it will forever be probably my favorite car design. I say that a lot, but this is probably like top two or three car designs in history. This is the 2000 BMW Z8. This was a super limited production car that they built in homage to the 507. I think it looks better than the 507, which is probably heresy for a lot of people, but I just think this is like such a perfect, like retro modern design. Like it definitely looks like it's got some old styling cues. It kind of has like the BMW mustache grill instead of like the big, like kidney style grill. Mm-hmm. But I just love the way this thing looks. And then when you get into the interior, I cannot get enough of this cabin. The wraparound piece of metal in front of you in the dashboard, the two-tone seats are super gaudy and super 2000s, but I love them so much. And then that wheel is the steering wheel, like with the banjo spokes, is amazing. It actually fits on the Z4, and I've been like looking casually to see if I could ever pick one up, but it's like a $5,000 part, so it's never going to happen for me. But I love the Z8 so much. I don't even care that it was a Bond vehicle. It had such a stupid part in what was it? The World Is Not Enough. It had like the stupidest, tiniest little role, but I just think it is probably the best looking BMW of the last, you know, certainly of the last 30 years. I think maybe the best looking BMW of all time, and easily one of my top five favorite automotive designs in history.
I think this is the reason that people continue to give Henrik Fisker money for things, even though they know he can't run a business to save his life. They're just like, they look at this and they're like, oh, man, how bad could it really be if he did this?
It's,
you know,
it's so funny to me because he did this. He did the Aston Martin Vantage, V8 Vantage. He did the Aston Martin DB9. Yeah. Like he did so many of the best looking cars of all time. And then there was the Fisker Karma, you know, like it's just a very curious, curious resume that that man has.
Yeah. This has the same engine as the E39 M5 as well.
I was just going to say, yeah, 4.9 liters, 394 horsepower. This was kind of like their answer to, you know, I remember it was in a comparison with the Ferrari 360 Modena and I can't remember what the other car in that comparison was, but and it was kind of like the takeaway was that like this was not a modern sports car. This was a 1950s sports car in 21st century materials. And that is all I want out of life. Like that is my raison d'etre 100% of the time. And the other cool thing about this car for everyone who bought one new is that it did not depreciate. It sold for $120,000 and a year later it was selling for $130,000 and now they are $150,000 to $250,000 all day long. So F me, I guess.
I remember seeing randomly, I think that there was a business owner, restaurant owner, bar owner in New Orleans who drove a Z8 who was on my walk to work. And so I would see one most days for a long time. And I remember thinking it was just completely weird the first time that I saw it to see it on the street, like amongst other cars, once you sort of recognize what it was. And then it started to blend in a little bit. I'm going to be honest with you guys. Maybe this is a hot take.
I don't want to hear it.
That this was one of the most beautiful cars ever. The more that I look at it as I get older, it is not aging well for me. It has a little bit of the, and this is where I'm going to get shouted at, like, new Thunderbird vibes. Like it's got a little Jay Mays to it. It's got a little like overwrought retroness.
You can expect my 2 weeks notice on your desk in 30 minutes.
And the other bit is, and this I truly wondered, I had to recheck when BMW led Mini launched. This isn't a bad thing at all, but I do see, I don't know what was happening, if there was any collaboration at all, but when you go back and you look at the cabin, there seem to be a lot of shapes and themes from Z8 that I can see as being translated in that first generation of Minis as well. Maybe
I can't disagree with that. It's like a very retro 2000s design for sure. I can't disagree that there is some shades of new Mini in the cabin.
I don't think that that's, and I don't have any issue with that either. I think maybe that was just in the air, the way that they were looking at it and they were approaching, especially with a lot of circles. It could just be that I'm responding to a lot of circles. But overall, again, I think this is a car that like in real life has a lot of presence. I think that it's super cool. It's gotta be a riot to drive. I'm sort of surprising myself a little bit because this, again, like this is a car that I've looked at over and over and over again. And I'm not sure what it is about it that just feels like it's got a little bit too much of that early aughts lipstick on it that bothers me.
But I'm having such a hard time right now. I can't even tell you. The worst part is I don't know how to argue you down. I don't know how to change your mind. Like I don't have the vocabulary or the emotional intelligence to tell you why you're wrong. Like you said a bunch of things that are like factually relative, like pretty accurate, you know, it's a 2000s car. It's got a retro design. I get it. I get where you're coming from. I just don't have the intelligence or rationale to like tell you why you're not right.
Well, it's also, I think that what we're saying is maybe the same thing. Like it's very much of an era, right? Like we know that it's retro. We know that it's based on 508, right? And it's very much of the early 2000s. So like what you and I bring to our own context to the early 2000s might be what we're talking about here too, you know, because I'm 10 years older than you are. So
I don't know. Like, cause I don't necessarily think of this as like, I know it is like a retro-ish design, but I don't necessarily think of this in the same, the same mentality as the Thunderbird or the New Beetle or the Mini Cooper. Like it feels like a much more cohesive and less like trendy look to me. It kind of just feels like if the 507 had been given, you know, 15 generational redesigns in between the 1950s and today, this kind of feels like what it would look like today. So I don't disagree with you on like a factual basis though. I think I just, maybe you're right. I just am having a more positive emotional reaction to it than you are.
Fair. It's all fair. Do you guys remember the Alpina? I think I sent a link to the chat, but the Alpina version of this, which was like, it's the weirdest Alpina ever because they pulled the M engine out. They put the regular, M62 B44 or whatever it was in it. They got rid of the manual transmission, gave it an auto, put those extremely attractive wheels on it. Added like some stuff to the interior. It's like the weirdest like redo, but like to make it into like they like old man spec'd it or something. But these things are somehow, I think they're worth as much or sometimes more than the regular Z8s, which blows my mind.
I'm the only person in the world that says this, but I know a lot of like Z8 owners put these wheels on their cars. I don't like them as much as the regular Z8 wheels, and I'm the only person in the world that feels that way. So, you know, I'll own that.
I'm generally like a big Alpina wheel advocate. Like, if there's an Alpina option, do it. Like, you know, the more spokes, the better. Frankly,
that is funny. I've never seen this car at all, and it's like I just love Alpina. I don't always love what they do, but I love that they approach whatever vehicle that they're working on with an absolutely independent spirit. Those weird ass shift buttons. God, I forgot all about those. They're so strange.
And they kept doing that on other cars too.
On the thumb for your thumbs.
Yeah.
What a weird thing. What a weird top they put on that too. I don't know that.
That's just the standard hardtop. That's just the standard Z8 hardtop.
Oh, okay. All right. My bad.
You really don't like the Z8, man.
I don't like this version. This is not a car that I would spend $200,000 on. No,
I'd rather have the standard one. The rear end of the Z8, the taillights in particular, that's the angle that does it for me on that car. Like, it's one of the best like rear ends.
That's true.
Like, it's just so good.
Yeah.
The like super graceful sloping like trunk line. I love it. Mm-hmm. But Seth has completely different proclivities when it comes to vintage BMWs, so let's jump on that.
Well, I mean, I appreciate your picking something that's a little bit outside of the mainstream. You know, Kyle got the Batmobile. One of us was going to pick an M1. M1 is just one of my favorite designs of all time, one of my favorite Jario designs of all time. I'm a big fan for, a 70s wedge, which is effectively what this is. The wheels are iconic. I love this one. So the picture that we're looking at right now is a listing that's live on Bring a Trailer, which is pretty cool. They've actually sold kind of a lot of these. I don't know how many they've resold over the years, but this is an auction right now that has a week left on it or a little bit more, and the car is going for $388,000. It looks like you need all of $500,000 to put one of these in your garage these days. Doesn't really make any sense from the standpoint of something that you would want to drive, although I'm sure they're completely wonderful. I've never had the pleasure of being behind the wheel, but it's mid-engine, 3.5 liter straight six, close to 270, 75 horsepower or something like that. They sound incredible. I've heard them run at, you know, like Car Week. And it's just, you know, it's an unmissable car. It's not, how do I say this? I think that if your average person like on the street who doesn't care about cars saw something like this, they might think it's a Lamborghini, right? Or guess that it's a quote unquote Ferrari or something like that. But anybody who knows anything about cars is going to see this from a half a mile away and understand what they're looking at. So it's just, you know, it's a dream car of mine from the first time that I started dreaming about owning cars and driving sports cars. So M1 is just it's in the pantheon, as they say, of cars that I care about. And I guess in that regard, the fact that they are not yet $1 million cars, I'm sure that some are that are quite famous or some of the early ones.
Like the pro cars, the race car ones probably are.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'd forgotten this, but they made 380 some of them, not quite 400 of them yet. So they're exceedingly rare. I'm sure they're all very well looked after if they haven't been trashed by a rock star in the 80s. So
I do love the Lamborghini connection with these cars because it's like the most unlikely mashup, you know, in automotive history at the time. And the fact that Lamborghini bungled it so badly that BMW had to come and take the chassis away to like finish the cars. It's great. Yeah. And the engine is phenomenal. I mean, it ended up seeing duty basically with a few modifications, like in the E28 M5, the E34 M5. And then, you know, two roundels in the back. Why not? I love it. It's so good. It's just, yeah, it's a great car. These things are awesome.
I love that. Like, this is like the genesis of most of the vehicles that we've talked about today is BMW Motorsport GmbH did not exist until the M1. Like, this was the M car. And then just because it was such a like great, you know, halo vehicle, they started building M3s and M5s and eventually M6s and Z4Ms and X5Ms and all this. Like, we can like trace the entire M lineage to this car. Like, this is a very, very cool, very significant vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's a nerd car as well, right? So if you are somebody that made a lot of money and over the course of that time, you've collected M3s and M5s and gotten into stuff that's increasingly fast or increasingly rare, this is the ultimate thing to own for a period of time to express your enthusiasm for BMW and for M as a brand, right? So I think that's kind of neat in and of itself. I like to see, and I'm not making a like a broad statement here based on knowledge, I've seen these cars driven around sometimes, right? It's not a car that I've only ever seen parked somewhere, although certainly I've seen more parked somewhere and in a museum and on a display than I have driven, being driven around. I like the idea that some people own these and drive them, which is not always the case for cars that are approaching this much, have this much value. But it seems like a kind of a BMW thing too.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, at least I was just gonna say, at least for now, like give it once they start hitting $1 million regularly, we'll probably see them pulled off the road too, right?
The thing that I really love about these is so these wheels have like a there's like a recut of these wheels by Rotiform, and I think they're just so freaking cool. I think they're like actually functional on the M1 where they suck air in or pull air out to like vent the brakes, but this is just like the ultimate in like late 70s, early 80s Gaudi, and absolutely love this car.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, again, this kind of thing, and then like the resurgence of wheel fans on aftermarket wheels. Like, give me all the turbo fans, always. If it's an option, it's not an option. I must have them, kind of thing.
Well, and the other thing that you know, speaking of this being like M's first car and it being like not based on an existing BMW product, it did that again 40 years later with the BMW XM, and they tried to like pay homage to the M1 with like these twin badges on the rear by like putting twin like embossings on the XM's rear hash glass, and it's the single most hateful thing about that car for me. Like,
out of so many things that could be hateful about that car,
I genuinely don't like the ethos of an M exclusive SUV. Doesn't bother me as much as it bothers so many people. The XM has a phenomenal interior. It drives really nice in a lot of different ways. The fact that they said, oh, look, it's our second M exclusive vehicle, and we're going to tell you how by putting these M1 aping at roundels on the glass. It made me so angry. Like, oh my gosh, I can't even tell you how mad it made me. Felt like a slap in the face.
I once described the XM as hostile architecture that you can drive.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But yeah, these things are, I love the M1. This is an
excellent pick.
We're running long on time, so I won't pull it up now, but I do remember there was like a short window of time when we thought, you guys, I'm sure, remember the M1 homage that was at Villa Dest. I don't even remember when, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, something like that. That looked a lot like an updated version. You know, it was a wedge-shaped mid-engine sports car. So for a while, we were living in a reality where the M1 homage was going to be the new M1.
Oh, yeah. And then it turned into the i8, or like, was i8 based or something?
Well, and then what it turned out, I know that there were a lot of things that happened between those things, but what we actually got as the next standalone M car was the XM, which was an even bigger bucket of cold water if you, like me, were still holding out hope that they were going to do a revision of an actual M1. There you go.
I completely forgot about the homage. This is a very cool machine.
Yeah. I always love their Villa d'Este stuff, like the Garmisch concept that they did, which ended up like sort of previewing the world to what the giant nose grill situation was going to be for the future. But like in the Garmisch concept, it worked really well. I thought that was a super handsome car. Yeah. And then they hurt us.
Well, maybe we should add a, because we want to do more of these, right? We want to do more where we're focusing in on collecting one brand. I think that's a fun topic of conversation. Hopefully, those of you who are watching and listening enjoy it as well. Maybe we should add a concept car category to this as well. That will take us, and we'll add a guest in a concept car, and then we'll be at a robust 2 hours, I'm sure.
Excellent.
This has been super fun, you guys. Good picks all the way around, as ever. If you have different picks than we do, or you have comments on ours, we would love to hear about them. Please leave us a comment wherever you are. We will get back and respond to you. You can always hit us up too with your list for your first car, or daily driver, and Concours car. You can email us at tips@carid.com. And in the meantime, if you don't do any of that, at least make sure to join us next week, Wednesday. We are here live at 10 a.m. Pacific time, 1 p.m. Eastern time every week. Some week we might even win concert tickets in the process. Who knows?
You didn't win concert tickets, but you nailed the Pacific time.
I was just going to say, for the first time in probably years of knowing you, you got that conversion perfectly.
Episode 10, guys. This is 10 episodes of the podcast. I've now got the intro and outro stuff not memorized, but I have the numbers right.
You're doing great.
Famously.
You're locked in.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. It's been a pleasure, and we will see you next week.
Bye, everybody.
Have a good one.